This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We start with the fifth day. So up till now, up till the fourth day, we've got the earth, we've got light, we've got sun and moon, we've got stars, we've got the water and the earth separated, and the earth is beginning to look quite habitable. Still no greenery, still no vegetation, and still no life. We've been discussing as we've been proceeding that what is created every day is not only certain objects, certain species, which is the way the Chumash reads on the surface, but certain human properties, certain dynamics, certain spiritual forces that would thereafter drive the world in every aspect of its activities and be relevant until this day and far beyond. And so we've tracked, as we've developed, the creation of energy and wisdom on the first day, the creation of confusion, almost the contrast of that energy, the possibility of disagreement, the possibility of seeing the same thing from different vantage points, and therefore the possibility of machlokes, of actual dispute, difference of opinion, created on the second day. The third day, the concept of compression, of being able to compress oneself, to be contained by something smaller than oneself, so that the content can be bigger than the container, so that the packaging never outshines the content. And then on the fourth day, was created the resolution of conflict, the fact that because there is machlokes, because there is the possibility of human beings developing their own viewpoints, there is the possibility of arrogance. With arrogance could come the denial of God, therefore the need of two forces, two lights, the sun and the moon, the diminishment of the moon, again compression, the moon having to reflect the light, not be a source of light on its own, the impact of that on human beings, what that meant to the man-woman relationship, to the masculine-feminine relationship, which means we already have masculinity and femininity. Although there's no man, there's no woman, they're not even animals, they're not even plants yet, there's no life. That masculine and feminine we have already. So masculine and feminine is not a biological fact. What now emerges, since we discussed masculinity and femininity and the relationship between them in some considerable detail last week before life was even created, we must conclude that masculinity and femininity preceded life. It is a force in the world. Like there is gravity in the world, so there is masculinity and femininity. That there's a polarity that operates, that creates a tension. And that has nothing to do with man and woman. Man and woman is one manifestation of that. Male and female in the animal world is another manifestation of that. That the power of masculinity and femininity as two forces operating is something that existed already on the second day, on the fourth day. Now we move into a very intriguing area of creation, the fifth day. Vayomer Elokim, and God said, Yishrutzu amayim sheretz nefesh chayo. Three words that are going to be important in our understanding. Literally translated, or simply translated as, let the land swarm, let the water swarm, from sheretz yishrutzu, with swarms of living life. And let birds fly on the land, and against the backdrop of the sky of the heavens. The Midrash says that that's referring not only to birds, but that angels were being created in this process as well, because we're talking about flying bodies in heaven, not just flying bodies down on earth. So flight was created, movement was created, the swimming fish and the flying birds. This was the creation of movement. And the word sheretz, Hirsch, who's the master linguist as far as we're concerned, says sheretz is phonetically linked to the word zarez. Zayin, reish, zayin is phonetically linked to shin, reish, tzadik. if you lisp and you can begin to understand the connection between a shin and a zayin and a tzadi and a zayin, they're phonetically similar letters, and the origins of the words are from similar sources. And zarez means energetic movement. So that being created here in Sheretz Nefesh Chayo is the creation of the force of energetic movement, both in birds, but particularly in the fish. Vayivro Elokim es hataninim hagedolim, and God created the big fish. And all the different types of living forms that swarmed in the sea, and all the birds of the sky, and God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters of the oceans. And may the birds multiply on the land. What's interesting here is we once again, for the first time since the first day, have the word Vayivro, God created. Created on the first day, created nothing on the second day, he created nothing on the third day, created nothing on the fourth day. All of that, as we discussed, were evolutions from the first day. He guided that process, he developed one thing from another, he placed things in position, but whatever existed during those 4 days, whatever he put in position during the first, second, third, and fourth day, were all created in that first moment of creation of Bereshis Bara, when God created energy from wisdom. That was creation. And we haven't had the word since then. God says, and let there be this, and let there be that, and he does this, and he makes that, but he doesn't create. For the first time here we have, Vayivro Elokim, God creates. And the only other time we have with creation is with man. So he creates the fish, he creates matter, energy, he creates fish, and he creates man. Not only that, but God blesses the fish and the birds. And he blesses man. He doesn't bless the animals, and he doesn't bless vegetation. We know that vegetation is also deserving of blessing. Sometimes crops also need to be blessed. But God does not bless the vegetation, and he does not bless animals. He only blesses the fish and the birds. Why? So we have a few different views on that. Let's have a look at them. Rashi is the simplest one. Those of you who have Rashi, if you'll have a look at it in verse Kafes. By Yevarei Chosom, verse 22 in the Rashi. See, each week we have fewer and fewer people following inside. Lefi shemechasrin oison v'tzodin mehem v'oichlin oison hutzruchu libroch. The reason the birds and the fish need blessing is because people hunt them. And since they form part of the food supply of human beings, they need blessing to compensate for the they're being hunted. Asks Rashi, "Va'afahayus hutzruchu livrochus." So what about the animals? They're also slaughtered. They're also hunted. Why do they get no blessing? Answers Rashi, "Yela mipnei hanochash she'osid lekalalo the katlo birchon shlo yehibuhu bichlal." God foresees he's going to have to curse the snake. And if he blesses all of the animal kingdom, he won't be able to pull the snake out for cursing later on. So he leaves the animals unblessed, so that he can curse the snake when he has to. Which is interesting that, although occasionally we hear of fish that become extinct, it's not very frequent. Animals become extinct. That the environmental pressures on animals can lead to the annihilation of species far more readily and far more easily than fish. And perhaps that has something to do with a special bracha that was given to fish and that was not given to animals. There are other reasons given why not. The Chizkuni says, because if animals were blessed, there would be no place for human beings to live. Imagine if animals reproduced at the rate that fish do. The world would be a scary place. So not only are we not worried, says the Chizkuni, about the effect of hunting, on the contrary, we're worried about the effect of animals on people, if animals have that power of blessing. And we'll see as man comes into the scene that God's intention with man is to dominate the world, is not to be consumed or dominated by the world, but to dominate the world. And if animals would have been blessed with this very prolific ability to breed, that would have damaged man's capacity to master the world and to make himself a place in the world. So man is, so the animals are not blessed. The Ramban gives a third view. The Ramban says the following, verse 22. Firstly, he defines bracha, which is quite interesting. And he says, Omar bohem shiyifru v'yirbu, he blesses the animals, the birds, the fish, that they may multiply, be fruitful and multiply. Koloma, that means shiyasu peros rabim, they should produce much fruit. Shiyotzi ho echod rabim kemoisa, that one should produce many. That's the essence of bracha. To take one and to create out of one a multitude of the same thing, that's bracha. Put $1 in the bank and come there a few days later and find there are a million of them, that's bracha. Start with one, now there's a million, that's bracha. You put a million in and you come and there's one, that's klola. That's curse. The opposite. Bracha is that God gave, put into the world, the capacity to multiply, the capacity to generate and regenerate. That's the power of bracha, and he gives it to the fish. The inyan abrocha beyelido, and bracha means giving birth, it means recreating. The gam bitzamochim tova loshen bracha, and vegetation should also have bracha. But why were they not given bracha on the third day? He says because the living creatures, animals, were created shnayim bilvad, only two were created. Two elephants were created, two lions were created, two leopards were created, two dogs were created, male and female, only two. Zohar and Akeva, Luminate. So again, we see the force of masculine and feminine created on the fourth day is put into practice on the fifth day as the power of recreation, as the power of bracha. Before there could be bracha, there had to be male and female. It's not that there has to be male and female, but it's not that there's bracha and then there's male and female. First there has to be male and female, and then there's bracha. Which ties into the meaning of a lot of our discussion last week, that there has to be a man and there has to be a woman for there to be bracha, for there to be able to be relationship and generation and children and marriage and everything that comes with that. There has to be masculinity and femininity to create the tension between male and female that is the bracha. That is the bracha, the tension between male and female. And because only two were created, from two to create a sustainable future of a species, that needs a lot of bracha. And that's how God built the world, with very little. You can start big things with little, very little, as long as you have an energy, a tension that can recreate. But when God started the vegetable world, he started with a fully planted farmyard. It was all completely laid out, it was completely planted, the world was covered with vegetation, and there was no need for bracha. So again, we're getting some clearer idea of bracha. When you start with a lot, and it just carries on being a lot, that's not bracha. Bracha is when you start with a little, and it grows. It grows and it grows. That's bracha. And bracha is introduced for the first time in the animal world because you start with two, male and female, and therein you have the capacity for regeneration. What's our question going to be? animals. And animals were also 2x2. The fish were 2x2, they got bracha. The birds were 2x2, they got bracha. Animals were also 2x2. Human beings were 2x2, they got bracha. What about the animals? Why didn't they get bracha according to the Ramban? Answers the Ramban. Shemizois ha-gezer she-gozar bevale ha-nefesh ha-tenua she-bamayim ha-ribui. The life force that God instilled in the fish for multiplication, with that same force, nisrabu bale nefesh ha-tenua she-boretz. So the animals of the land were given that same force. Ki bale nefesh chayo she-eno medaberet kulon inyon echot bevriyosom. Because all animals are one. This was a long time before anybody thought of Darwin. That God created fish, he gave them the life force, and it all came from the fish. Incredible. There we have it, hundreds of years before Darwin. And that's why to talk about conflict between science and religion, that's right. But to talk about conflict between science and Torah is idiotic. Because there's nothing that science has come up with that isn't in the Torah. There's nothing that science has come up with that has caught us by surprise, and that we've had to say, oh my goodness, if that's the scientific explanation, what are we going to do with Chazal? It's never ever happened. Whenever science has come up with a new explanation, we've said, finally, they've got it. They've got it. Look here, we've been saying this, we've been teaching Cheder children, and they finally caught on. There's not one scientific theory that has caused us to question the Torah. Other religions are different. When they discovered the world was round, everybody said the world had four corners. All other religions were in a tumult. What are they going to do with this? Science must be wrong. They were burning scientists because they were witches and they were heretics. And then when there was evolution, that was a terrible thing. No big terrible thing. If you want to claim there was evolution and there was no God, that's a problem. That's not a scientific theory. That's mad speculation. It's not science's business to discuss whether there's a God or not. Science wants to get in there. That's not science. What science has proved, we've never had a difficulty. On the contrary, as we've seen on each day of creation, I've been able to show you principles in Chazal stated clearly hundreds and hundreds of years, sometimes more than that, before they were discovered by science. So the Ramban says, if you look at it, you'll see very clearly the fish are blessed, the vegetables are not blessed. Why? They were covered all over. Animals did not develop from vegetables. Here and there, science has got it wrong. They'll come right eventually. It didn't all evolve from one source. The first 4 days all evolved from one source. But then God added another dimension. So that evolutionary process continued, and I'm using the word evolution, although I don't mean it in the sense of pure survival of the fittest and a sort of chance development. Obviously, that's not what I'm talking about. When I'm talking about evolution, I'm talking about the way God developed it, the way God evolved the world. So Hashem evolves the world from that first creation right through the 4 days, then adds another component in, and the evolution continues with what there was plus a new component. And the evolutionists have not been able to explain how animal life came from plant life. They can explain the evolution of plants, and they can explain the evolution of animals, and they have a lot of difficulty with the linkage. They have a lot of difficulty with the origin. Big Bang, yes, Big Bang, no, Big Bang. They don't know. And they cannot know because that's not science. So the first Bria, the word creation, science grapples with. That which God created on the first day, science cannot understand. But from there onwards, from the moment of creation till the end of the 4th day, science can explain. From the 5th day, science can explain. The linkage between the 4th day and the 5th day, science has got a little bit of a problem with that. Why? Bria, there was another creation. What was it that God created on the 5th day? That's what we've got to see. What was this new component that God threw in on the 5th day that wasn't a simple evolution from the first part of life? So according to the Ramban, what it was animal life. Animal life, by animal life we mean as animal life as defined by the verse itself when it says, Sheretz Nefesh Chaya. Here again, Hirsch has an important analysis of those three words. Sheretz, we said, was movement. The energetic movement. That's Sheretz. In plant life, there's no energetic movement. There's no movement at all, other than movement caused by an external stimulus. that there's no movement of the organism itself. Nefesh, that is a word that Hirsch explains as being a central driving force in an organism. So a plant doesn't have a central nervous system, doesn't have a brain and a nervous system at all. Each part of the plant operates on its own, almost each cell operates on its own. And that's why you can cut off part of the plant and you can plant it and it will grow into a new plant. You can take a seed and plant it, it will grow into a new plant. Cut off a branch. The life of each part of the organism functions independently from the rest of the organism. Although it's connected and it's fed from the organism, you can break it off and it can carry on living. You can't do that with an animal. You can't do that with a human. You can't break off part of him and expect it to carry on living, because an animal is driven by a center point. The nefesh, the life force, the central nervous system. And nefesh goes beyond that, because nefesh is also the power that moves. The movement of sheretz, the energetic movement that is created, is a movement driven by nefesh, which is the central nervous system. So in that comes also the power to will movement. So movement is not accidental, and movement is not just something chaotic or reflexive. Movement is the result of nefesh. It's the result of the animal choosing to move. That's what movement is, and powering his movement with that desire, with that will to move. The nefesh contains the will. Chayo, life, Chaim, Hirsch defines as being the capacity of an organism to select. Because a living organism selects that which is hospitable to it, or it which is to be hospitable to, and is capable of rejecting that which is hostile to it. It will reject a transplant, an inclusion that is not similar to it. It will reject that, it will expel that. And so life, the life that's created on this day, unlike the life of the previous days, is life that has the energy of movement driven by will and capable of selection. That's not the selection of free will, this is an instinctive selection, but it's the beginning of will. Whereas before this day there is no will. On this day, will is created. Even the organism, even the animal, has the capacity to will movement and to select. Almost companionship. It's able to select what it wants to assimilate, and it's able to select what it wants to reject, and it can reject that which is bad for it and assimilate that which is good for it. So before the introduction of free choice, because free choice only comes with a human being, there is already the natural capacity to select that which is good for us and to reject that which is not good for us. And so, says the Ramban, we have blessing for the birds, we don't have blessing for the animals, because the animals are just a natural extension of the birds and the fish, and the blessing given on the fourth day to the fish is the same blessing that carries through the animal world, because the creation is the same creation. There was no new creation for animals. Animals evolved from fish, says the Ramban. But there's another level that we have to see in terms of this creation. Because if you look at the words, once again in the verse itself, Vayivra Elohim, and God created Es Hataninim Hagdolim. It doesn't say Taninim Gedolim. It doesn't just say all the fish. It doesn't say, and he created big fish. It says he created the big fish. And all the other fish. What is this big fish? Says Rashi, if you look at your Rashi in verse Kafalet, in verse 21, Taninim are Dagim Gedolim Shebeyom, the big fish of the sea. The Divrei Agada, and in the Medrash, Rashi quotes, Hu Lev Yoson Uven Zugo, that is Mr. and Mrs. Lev Yoson. He created two Lev Yoson, a male Lev Yoson and a female Lev Yoson. Now, of all the creatures of the creation, there is none more fascinating than the Lev Yoson. He's probably more fascinating than the human being himself. And we know much less about him than we know about the human being. But we'll try and unravel a little bit of it tonight just to get some kind of sense of whom this Leviathan is. Midrashic material is filled with him. Gemara makes reference to him. The beautiful stories of Yonah that we read on and in particular the stories behind the sea are very fascinating, where Jonah is thrown into the sea and is swallowed by the fish, and the fish says, "We're in trouble, Jonah." And Jonah says, "What's the trouble?" He says, "We're going to meet up with the Leviathan, this mighty monster that God created down in the sea, and he's going to eat us. This is my time to go. So it's been a pleasant ride, but I'm warning you, the ride is over. We're both being eaten by the Leviathan." "Oh," says Jonah, "great, I've always wanted to see this Leviathan. Take me. Let me have a look at the Leviathan and I'll save you. Don't worry about being consumed." And he goes and he looks at the Leviathan, this magnificent animal, and he converses with the Leviathan, and he says, "One day I'm going to eat you," he says to the Leviathan. And he shows the Leviathan that he's descended from Avraham, and the Leviathan gets such a fright, he runs away, and the fish is saved, and so the story goes. There have been some human encounters with this Leviathan. We don't know what it is, this enormous fish, and look what Rashi says here from the Medrash. And what did God do? Where are these Leviathans? Zochor and create the male and female. The horag es hanakevo, he killed the female, umolchol tzadikim losid lavoi, and he pickled it for the tzadikim to enjoy in the future. This is Leviathan. God creates her, kills her, pickles her, and puts her away. And the Rashi doesn't say here what he did to the male. There's only one Leviathan male, there's only one Leviathan female. He kills the female and pickles her and still castrates the male, which he did. Why? As Rashi, she'im yifru v'yirbu, because if they were to get together and multiply, lo yiskayim ha'ilam b'flame, the world couldn't stand before them. This is a force so powerful that the world couldn't exist. So God pickles the female, keeps it for the future, they can't multiply, and they become extinct. So who said they weren't dinosaurs, except that where science gets it wrong is they were much bigger than the scientists think they were, and there were only two. What is this Leviathan? And that is the Taniman. God created the big fish. And the Ramban gives another view, again dealing with the question of what was it that God created on the fifth day, whereas previously everything evolved. What did he create on the fifth day, and why is this day separate? The Ramban says the following. These fish are enormously large. Egidu hayavonim b'sifreim, the Greeks claim, says the Ramban, sheyodu behem, that they were aware of these fish, that they have a tradition about these fish too, these enormous monstrous animals, and that they were aruchim chamesh meot parsel, they were 500 parsels long. A parsel is probably about a kilometer. These things, they were big, they were very big. And the Chazal also talk a lot about them, and I'll do one Gemara with you. That's why it says God created them, because this was a creation as revolutionary as the creation of the world on the first day. So in this view of the Ramban, he's saying evolution continued through the fifth day. The only thing that didn't evolve with it was the Leviathan. Everything else, all the other animals, and the other interpretation I gave you, the Ramban says, there was an additional component. Life was created. So there was some form that continued to evolve, but an added dimension that was life. And life was energetic movement, central nervous system, and will. That was created on the fifth day. Here the Ramban is saying, a species was created on the fifth day from nothing. It was a new creation. Just like the world was created on the first day, the Taninim, the Leviathan, was created on the fifth day. And this being was powerful, big, and God afterwards destroys it. That's all he tells us. The Gemara tells us just a little bit more. The Gemara says in Bava Basra and Daf Ayin Dalet that Kol ma shebaro HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'olamoy zochor unakeva bara. Everything that God created in the world, he created male and female. Again, interesting. It doesn't say every animal or every creature. It says everything. that there is a male and female force in everything. Af Levioso, even the Levioso, had elements of Nachash Beriach, Beriach, the Levioso Nachash Akhalosa. It had the element of Levioson, the male element, which was Nachash Beriach, a powerful Nachash, a powerful snake, serpent, and Nachash Akhalosan, a crooked one, which was the female component. Zochor Nekeva Beroy. And the Gemara here says, Vilmolid is cocking Zelozen, if the male and female go together, Macharivim Kol Ha'ilam Kulo, they would completely destroy the world. What did God do? He castrated the male and killed the female. Now, let's try and get some understanding of what the Levioson is. For this we'll use Rabbeinu Bechaya. We have to do this inside with you so that we're able to develop a clear understanding. The Rabbeinu Bechaya brings a medrash. So now our sources for the Levioson that we're dealing with are Rashi, who tells us that the big fish created on the fifth day was the Levioson. We have the Gemara in Bava Basra that tells us that God created everything male and female, even the Levioson, and that if they got together, they would destroy the world. And we have a Medrash in Vayikra that is as follows. Rabbi Brechia B'Shem, Rabbi Yitzchok says, Aristoin Godol Osid HaKadosh Baruch Hu La'asus La'tzadikim, La'osid Lovo. One day in the future, God is going to make an enormous meal, a dinner, for the tzadikim. V'chol mi shaloi ochal nevelus utreifus v'olam hazeh. And whoever never ate treif in this world will be invited to that dinner. Sorry, that means some people aren't going to be there. And what will that meal be? What will God dish up? Something you never tasted yet. A nice, good, juicy, well done, medium or rare done, however you prefer it, piece of Levioson. That's what you're going to have to eat. Now what does all that mean? Explains the Rabbeinu Bechaya. Clearly that doesn't mean a physical meal that we're going to sit down and eat Levioson meat, because we're talking about the Elsid Lovoi, we're talking about the souls in the world to come. That isn't going to be just to fill our stomachs. That's not what Olam Habo is about. So why use the image of Levioson meat and eating and a su'udo? Why are we so obsessed with food? The goyim are right. The Jews are obsessed with food, not only in this world, but even in Olam Haba. And other religions are onto all sorts of esoteric things that will happen, and the Muslims, you know what they say, they'll be there. What are we going to have in Olam Haba? A Levioson meal we'll be able to have. That's our idea of Olam Haba. Says the Rabbeinu Bechaya something very important about eating. Elo shekvar noyedo, it's clearly known, shebesibas ha-maichal v'ha-mishte, that because, through the reason, by the cause of eating and drinking, yisoyeru koichles ha-guf, that actually energizes the powers of the body, not just the nutritional value. The process of eating, the process of enjoying a meal, does something to our physical beings. And as a result of arousing our physical senses, our spiritual forces, and nefesh, there are different levels of spirits. When we talk about the guf, which is the body, nefesh is the life force. That's the nervous system, the brain. It's the living force in the human being. It's already something more spiritual. And beyond that, the life force of the human being is also intensified. The eater, the person who's eating, can focus the energy gained from the food on certain parts of his life force, of his spiritual being. So eating for a Jew is not just about food. And that's why we've got it on Shabbos, is around eating and all these things as you develop. Food, the process of eating, is a critically important part of spiritual awakening, not only physical awakening. Because eating and drinking is a major reason, a major cause of inner joy. And that's why people put on weight when they're upset, when they're unhappy. Because eating is a source of joy. We have to work out how to manage that, how to use it, what to do about it. And it does wonders for removing of sadness and depression. And it's well known that through having a lot of joy, that energizes the mind. The mind doesn't do well when it's held down and it's worried and it's depressed and it's oppressed. It has to be uplifted. And one of the mechanisms we have for uplifting is a meal. One can more easily grasp upper things, high things, abstract things, difficult issues, if one is happy. As we see with Elisha, says he's got to prophesy, and Elisha says, "Kuchuli menagen, bring the musicians. I need music." Prophet needs music? Yes, needs music. And I doubt very much that the music he was talking about was the music one hears at weddings and bar mitzvahs. That I don't think was the music that Elisha wanted to, in order to elevate himself to higher levels of understanding of God. And Chazal said, "Ein shechino shoyre lo mitrich atzlus v'lo mitrich atzlus." God's presence does not rest on a person when he is lazy or when he is depressed. It doesn't come. There's no godliness when a person lacks energy or he's depressed. In other words, if he's inactive, if there's two reasons for no energy: either you're lazy or you're sad, you're depressed. It's one of those two. It doesn't matter which one. No energy, no godliness. There's no godliness in this kind of elamitoch devar simcha. It comes out of joy, out of happiness, out of brightness, out of energy. That's where the Shechina is. Ucheinyan hamatamim shishol Yitzchak, as when Yitzchak wanted to bless his son Yaakov, this was now instilling in Yaakov and hence the Jewish people the spiritual force that would guide them for all eternity. So just think of the scene. Imagine a movie is being created. Imagine the theatrics of it. Here's Yaakov. The moment is the moment where he's about to set the Jewish nation into motion. He's going to draw on all his spiritual resources and transfer them onto his sons, into his son. Yitzchak, the son of Avram, the father of Yaakov, the link between the originator and the founder of the nation. The originator, Avram, where it all started, and Yaakov, the one who set 12 tribes in motion. Yitzchak is the link, and he's now going to transfer everything he knows. And his son says, "Bless me." And he says, "Sure. Where's the food?" "Bring a meal. Let's eat. Let's have a kiddush." How do we understand that? "Bavu tevarecho nafshi, so that my soul will bless you," says Rabbeinu Chaya Bechaya. "Loi omar ba'avur avarecho." He doesn't say so that I will bless you. You want me to bless you? That's easy. I'll babble a blessing. But if you want my soul in it, let's eat together first. Let's have a seudah. Let's sit down. Beautiful food, beautiful music, delicious taste, good company, a good glass of wine, and then let me give you a bracha. Then I will be incorporating my nefesh." Says Rabbeinu Bechaya, you see the power of food to alert, to awaken the powers of the soul. And that's a secret that only we Jews know. Every religion knows how to do all sorts of religious things, and all the hedonists know how to do all sorts of hedonistic things. But the secret that food opens the soul is something that no other religion knows. Now, if we're talking about spirituality in food, then we're not talking about quantities of food. And that's where the whole question of obesity comes in. We've discussed that previously, that when you try and get everything out of the mass of the food, then you need enormous quantities of food to try and feel happy. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about spiritual qualities. And what are the spiritual qualities in the food? The taste. I'm talking about the nutritional value. Nutritional value. You can take a vitamin pill. That's not a meal. That doesn't bring the Shechina. If you lay out all your little vitamin pills and you take a protein drink and you have one of these bars that you have there, Bob, and then you unwrap it, you bunch your bar and you drink your protein drink and you take your vitamins, don't expect prophecy. There's not going to be a Shechina coming as a result of that. You've got all the nutritional value. That's not what the Rabbeinu Bechaya means when he talks about a meal. talks about a meal. He talks about a meal where it's quasi-spiritual. It's almost not physical. It's a spiritual experience. It's a symphony of flavor, of smell, of aesthetic, of appearance, of conversation. That it's almost a religious thing, but it just has a physical part to it that links the human being's life force to the spiritual. All you need is a little bit of the physical to create that linkage. But the others, taste, and the aromas, and the ambience, and the companionship, and the conversation, and the wine, is it the right proportion and the right quality? That's not about physical. That's all about spiritual. That's about penetrating to something way beneath its surface and accessing a quality from that thing. Not a quantity, accessing quality. And when you're involved in the accessing of quality and the incredible enjoyment of quality, you're moving into the qualitative. To be able to access quality is relatively easy, but you don't enjoy it. To enjoy quality, but you have not accessing it. But in food, you're able to access quality and enjoy it. And when you're accessing quality and enjoying it, your soul is open to the qualitative. And when your soul is open to the qualitative, your mind is open to the qualitative, and your soul is open to God. And that's why meals are incredibly important. That's why there's such kedusha. That's why a table is a mizbeach. A table is an altar. That's why we put salt on the table. Everybody's very religious about throwing salt all over their challah. That's not the important part. The important part is to have salt on the table, to demonstrate that this is an altar, because there was always salt on the altar. This is a religious experience. Over and over again, this is a religious experience. Now, if it's a religious experience, then we see how we go about our religious experiences, but we're not consistent. We see it how we go about the whole concept of Hidur Mitzvah. We've just come out of Sukkot, Lulav and Esrog. Jews throughout the world, religious Jews, will spend thousands, hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars on a Lulav and Esrog. You can get a kosher Lulav and Esrog for, what do they start at? They start at $40. You can probably get cheaper than that in parts of the world. You can do less than that as well. But there are people who spend many hundreds of dollars, many hundreds of dollars. What's the difference? Appearance, perfection, beauty, and then they'll buy a beautiful case for the esrog, and they'll protect it very carefully and look after it very beautifully. Sukkahs, we know how to make beautiful sukkahs. There's such a concept as hidur mitzvah, as making a mitzvah look beautiful. Is that materialistic? No, it's a law, it's a halacha. You're supposed to spend a third on beautifying the mitzvah. And there are two views. Does a third mean a third of the essential cost? So if you're going to spend $100 on just doing the mitzvah, spend at least another 33 on making it beautiful. And according to some, it's a third of your income. But a third of your income should go into the aesthetics of the mitzvahs you do. That's how important Chazal regards hidur mitzvah. Hidur means beauty, glory, making it look good. That's what it's all about. Chanukah is all about hidur, about making it look beautiful. So if a meal is a religious experience, and this means every meal, breakfast, lunch, dinner, not just Shabbos, is a religious experience, how should it be? What should a meal look like? And one wonders, if Darwin is right, at what point did human beings learn to make a ritual out of a meal? Seen animals eat? Have you seen, I was going to say, have you seen human beings eat and how different it is? Well, no. Have you seen human beings sitting down to a dinner, to a real meal? Where did they learn that? Where did it come from? If eating is just about eating, just about food, about satisfaction, of hunger, and of nutrition. Where did they learn from to lay a table, to put beautiful silverware and glassware on? Where did that come from? It came from us. We taught eating as a religious service. The non-Jewish world has kept the ritual. They don't know why, but it's a ritual. And they've kept it. We've lost it. They've preserved it for us. Sad. terribly sad. Not all of them, not all of us have lost it, and not every non-Jew eats the way it should be. But they know what a ritual is, they know how to set a dinner, they know how to conduct themselves at a dinner. And that's what eating is. And so the Rabbi de Bechaya goes on to explain that when we talk about eating the Lev Yosom, there are certain foods that are more spiritual than others. So if you take a staple, for example, that's probably less spiritual. But in fact it was energy. It doesn't matter, they're transferable. That energy could have been transferred into a fish. And that's what it means. God took the energy and pickled it. He didn't make it into a fish. He took the energy and he put it away for the future. It's energy that could become matter. And when it becomes matter, it will become a beautiful dish if God wants to serve it up to us. But at the moment, it's still energy. What is the energy? What is that? Explains Rabbeinu Bechaya. It is the relationship between seichel and nefesh. Intellect and life force. That's what it is. The word Lev Yosom comes from the word Levayo. Levayo, funeral. Levayo means, doesn't mean a funeral. Levayo means accompaniment. You accompany the body. That's a Levayo. Levayo is also the mitzvah. If you have a guest, you're supposed to do Levayo, which means accompany him out. See him out. See him down your pathway. See him to his car. Go out with him. That's Levayo. Levayo is company. Attachment. And therefore the Lev Yosom is attachment. In Kabbalah there are various things as to what this attachment is. Some learn it as social attachment, and we might have a chance to get into that, but not tonight. Some the attachment between man and God, which we're also not going to get into tonight. Rabbeinu Bechaya learns it as the attachment of intellect to life force, nefesh and seichel. Two forces. And then what the Gemara would be saying, if these two forces really got together, the world couldn't contain them. That's how powerful they would be if they got together. Because once bracha is in the world, the male and female force, when they come together, multiply. And you can't hold it back. What is the force here? He says, if seichel, if nefesh dominated seichel, nefesh is the is the container, nefesh is the material, and seichel, intellect, the idea. So in the male-female image, the male would be the intellectual idea, the vision, and the container, the material, that which makes the vision real, the nefesh, would be the female. If the female dominated the male, the nefesh dominated the seichel, then there would be nothing spiritual in the world. There would be no intellect in the world. The world would just be around satisfying desires, around sensuality. There would be nothing spiritual in the world. If the seichel dominated the nefesh, if the male dominated the female, then the world would also be destroyed, because there would be no reproduction, there would be no sexuality, there would be no sensuality. People would not build and do anything. And therefore, there is a need for the two to operate together. But we don't live in a time, in an age, where the two have ever operated together. We live in an era where they're constantly pulling one way. Sometimes the one dominates, sometimes the other dominates. In our own lives, in society, there's a pendulum movement from one to the other. Because when the two get together and truly work as one, when there's true levayo, when the seichel and the nefesh truly work together as one, there will be complete destruction. Another area that the Rabbeinu Bechaya uses to explain, and that will perhaps make it a little clearer for you, is two different forces, and that is the force of diplomacy and the force of power. The force of seductiveness and the force of forthrightness. Would be good interpretations. One reference to share with you, but it slipped out of my hands. So there you go. The force of forthrightness is the masculine force, truth. This is how it is, confrontation. And the force of seductiveness is, there's another way you can get a person round. manipulate the person around. Talk to the person subconsciously, you can get to them this way, you can get to them that way. Both valid ways of getting, of creating change. You can create some change sometimes by confronting a person with the truth straight, and you can do it in a sort of a courteous roundabout way. The Israelis are very good at what they call dugri, that's how it is, and the West is very good at talking in languages that it's quite difficult to unravel and to figure out what they really mean in order to try and get to a point without really offending you on the way, and usually what happens is that they don't make the point at all. And then everybody feels much more comfortable because the point wasn't made. But says this, so this is not Rabbeinu Bechaya, this is the Maharal, if those two forces cooperated, if the powers of seduction and forthrightness could work as a team, then the world would be conquered. It would be so powerful a tool that nothing could resist the degree to which it would be compelling. And God keeps that away from the world, so that God can come to the world. Just isn't ready for that level of power. And that's what the Tanin was. I'm giving you these not because we're capable of understanding them in any kind of great depth, but to understand, firstly, this isn't about monsters and fish and dinosaurs. This is about certain male and female forces in the world. A continuation of the creation of male and female originated on the fourth day with the two lights. When the moon was diminished, there was already the introduction of male and female. Male and female forces are now intensified millions of times in the creation of the Tanin. Whether the Tanin is Seichel and Nefesh, or the Tanin is the crooked snake, the roundabout way, and the straight way, as the Gemara talks about it and the Maharal explains. Whatever we're going to understand this as this male and female force, there are many things in the world where there's a male way of doing it that works, and there's a female way of doing it that works. But put those together in Lev Yosser, in a way where they link, where they really work together, and the power is absolutely compelling. The power cannot be overcome by any other force in the world, and that's what was created on the fifth day. And when God created Es HaTaninim HaGedolim, that two major forces, calls them fish, call them whatever they want, they come from the water, two major forces, a male force and a female force, and he puts the forces away. Having been created, they're latently there, but they're not able to breathe, they're not able to interact fully. There's a distance between them, there's a separateness between them, which enables the world to continue to exist. And it's with that force that God creates, and this is not an evolution, this is a creation, which would then mean that the tensions of sexuality, and we're not talking about it in a human sense only, nor in an animal sense only, we're talking about it in a much more universal sense than that. The creation of sexuality then, of the tension between the male and the female force, was as much of a bria, as much of a creation ab nihilo, from nothing, brand new, as was the creation of the world on the first day. God creates the world on the first day, evolves it through, adds an additional component on the fourth day, on the fifth day, and that's the component of the sexual tension. And now he's ready for the sixth day, the creation of animals and the creation of man, which we'll study in greater detail next week.